Houston, we have a problem.
And it's not going away for the next 26 minutes.
And now we're pleased to bring you our feature presentation.
Yes, it's time once again for Radio Free X-Man.
What's Radio Free X-Man?
We've got 11,000 people at NASA trying to figure that out right now.
Radio Free X-Man's beloved cast of broadcast entertainers are back.
You all know people like this. You may be people like this.
Now, the charming and delightful president of X-Man Mortgage and host of Radio Free X-Man, Bob.
Your head is freakishly large.
Brooks.
Coming at you from sunny Galveston. Do not be fooled by the blue skies. No, it's about 113 degrees Fahrenheit out here, and the humidity, I think, is 8 million.
Normally, Galveston is a lot cooler than Houston, but you've been suffering on your forced exile slash expensive vacation, haven't you?
Well, I got to tell you, the distance to the swim-up bar is almost too much in the pool here. But I make it because that's the kind of sacrifice that we here at X-Man do for you, the customer.
The swim-up bar. Give me more info here.
The swim-up bar is manned by a dude named Adam. We're at the Hilton here on sunny Galveston, and Adam is always there ready with whatever you want, nachos, a tasty brewski, whatever.
Sounds like torture.
Somehow I make it through. This hotel, I think, is owned by Tillman Fertitta, like about half of the coast. And he does a pretty good job, generally speaking, but he does like to charge a la carte for everything here, and I noticed, you know, well, I would like to get on the internet. Well, that'll be $10. I'd like to have my car valet parked. Well, that'll be $10, too. I'd like to sneeze. That's $10, too. And what it does is it's a way, I guess, to make your room rate, which is, well, sounds pretty good over the phone when you're talking with hotels.com or whatever, kind of go up such that before you know it, hey, I didn't know I spent $400 a day.
It's unbundling, just like they charge you for the Band-Aid and the hospital visit when you go to ER.
Yes, they sure do. Yeah, and don't even try and get an aspirin here.
How's the tax goddess and the little X children enjoying the vacation?
They are indeed. They really love the pool. For some reason, they love the beach here. You know, I speak lovingly of Galveston as someone who grew up in the Houston-Galveston area and came here all the time. I guess for the past 30 years, I've been doing this, you know, since I was a little kid.
Hey, I love Galveston, too. I have the same story as you.
That's right. I will tell you that I love it, but I'll also tell you this is kind of a miserable beach compared to other beaches because it is. It's the sands of hell out there, and the water is, I guess, about 120 degrees. It's just hot water and really hot winds. But, you know, we still come here. We love it anyway. I guess it's a bit like marriage. Well, you know, while we're on the subject of mortgage, I was thinking that today we could discuss appraisals and the importance of the appraisal process in the mortgage calculation, if you will.
I always had the sense that appraisers are kind of unregulated and that they had a dangerous power to push market prices around by arbitrarily assigning values to properties. What can give me comfort that they do actually have to follow some procedures?
Well, they are regulated by the state. And what's going to be your catch-all, what's going to be your safety, generally speaking, is the underwriter of the lender that you're going to use. For example, it's a loan officer and a mortgage broker's job to get the business, to go out and get the loan, okay? The underwriter says, well, now we're going to protect the company and make sure that the loan is legitimate and make sure that someone's not picking this little house, which is worthless, and trying to make it a $400,000 house. Some crooked appraiser or some crooked mortgage broker or some crooked somebody somewhere.
Some crooked Friendswood municipality tax base that writes letters back and forth between appraisers and city councilmen saying we need to get 10% more revenue from these properties.
Amen, sister. Ain't that the truth?
It happened.
Oh, yeah. But not with X-Man Mortgage. Heavens no.
Heavens no.
In any case, the underwriter, generally speaking, will look to protect the company as much as the customer is going to be wanting to protect themselves because nobody wants the customer to go default. And nobody wants you saddled with a house that is just crazy overpriced. Now, that being the case, there are gray areas where stuff gets pushed. And generally speaking, you'd want to seek out a good appraiser, just like you'd want to seek out a good mortgage person. Now, we here at X-Man do know very good, very conservative, and solid appraisers. It's about doing a little shopping and a little research, mm-hmm. and that's whether you're buying suitcases or whether you're dealing with mortgage folks. Always do a little bit of shopping and do a little research. Listening to this program, I'm not sure how much research you're doing, but maybe you're having a good time anyway.
Hey, at least it's easy research.
That's right. That's right. Just sit there and turn the brain off. Tell Adam at the swim up bar to turn the radio up.
Bring some blue corn nachos.
That's exactly right. How did you know?
I've never even been to your house, but you're a blue corn nachos kind of guy, Bob.
Aren't I there? Why don't you try some of the blue corn and nachos?
Natural market forces are at work in people. The seller wants the house to be priced as high as possible. The buyer wants it to be as low as possible. What are the chances that either or both of those people have any influence on an appraiser?
Oh, they completely do. Absolutely. And in fact, most appraisers will say, well, would you please send over a contract between the seller and the buyer before I even get started on this? He wants to make sure there's actually two legitimate parties out there who are indeed behaving according to market forces at work. Now, like I said, there are all sorts of games that can be played, and people do try to play those games. You know, if we blow the price of this house up really high, I'll buy it from you with 100% financing, and then we'll get some money out of it, too. You know, that's naughty. Don't do it. Don't get caught doing it.
You're just a kook fringe conspiracy theorist with a freakishly large head.
That's me, and you can recognize me on the street, too. I'm the one with the black helicopter painted on the side of my large head.
All right, the tax goddess is now with us on the phone. You still have a skin? Did you find enough SPF 50,000 down there?
Not quite enough, unfortunately.
Are you done yet, or do you have another day in the oven?
One more day in the oven, and then we'll head back home.
All right. Well, this has been a nice, long, juicy vacation.
Yeah. And it's really nice because it's been about 2 years since we got away even for so much of a long weekend.
I wondered about that. You have the two little ix children and you both work all the time with your different businesses, and it seems to me like you're the perfect couple to just pass out from stress because you never relax.
That is so true. I am the most stressed out person you've probably ever met.
Let's get one thing straight. Take it out on Bob, all right?
Oh, I always do. That's why I got that dent in the back of his head.
Great. Well, have you met any celebrities down there at Galveston this week?
No, but we found some great restaurants.
Tell me about them.
Well, there was one we went to about 2 years ago, and we went back and were not disappointed. It's called the Water Wall. It's on the Strand, and they have these Angus hamburgers mm-hmm. that are the best hamburgers we've ever had anywhere. I mean, they're even better than the ones we make at home.
Do they have special recipes for loading them up, or are you just doing it the traditional way?
No, just the traditional way. The meat is that good.
Wow.
I don't know what they're putting in it, but they are amazing.
I already dug out the secret of the blue corn nachos at the Swim Up Bar from Bob. What other restaurants have you been to?
Last night we went to a little tiny restaurant called Di Bella's. It's an Italian restaurant. In fact, we called and they were about to close. We said, look, we'll leave the hotel in 5 minutes, and actually stayed open just to accommodate us.
Oh, you mean they were about to close because of what time it was? I thought you meant they were about to just shut their doors and your meal saved their business.
We eat a lot, but not quite that much.
Viva Di Bella's. Now, have you been to Guido's yet?
Yeah, we went to Guido's Monday night. Excellent, but what would you expect?
Put Tori on.
Okay, hold on 1 second. Demi Goddess number one. Mr. Perkins would like to speak with you.
Hello?
We're on the radio, so don't say anything too precocious.
Okay.
What's your favorite restaurant so far?
Probably Di Bella's.
Viva Di Bella's. What did you have?
I had fettuccine alfredo.
Well, what did Lexi have?
Lexi had some type of pasta with garlic and olive oil. Here, do you want to ask her? Hello?
Hey, did you eat anything at Guido's that was staring back at you from your plate?
Fortunately, not.
That's not something you do just on a whim, huh?
I guess not.
What's your favorite restaurant so far?
Well, I guess it would be Guido's, because the soft shell crab was really good. It was deep fried. That's why it was so good.
Mm-hmm. Actually, phone noises.
Yeah, Dave, we actually got in some range time at the oldest country club in Texas, oldest private country club in Texas, yes.
Did you really? Well, how'd you hit him?
How did I hit him? I don't even remember how we hit him. You know, you're just happy to be there, and it's very nice, and it's windy, and it's kind of weird.
Badly, but just doesn't want to admit it.
Yeah, we sucked, Dave. That's what I'm trying to say. But
how long has this guy played organized sports? I mean, he's a professional. He's been in, what, the European League for 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
He's played, you know, club sports, whatever else, all this time. This has never happened to him before. This guy's got some special talent.
It was for Mother France.
Oh, God.
It was for all our mothers and sisters in the motherland of France that I broke that guy's sternum.
I was going to say, it would have helped the mothers and sisters and daughters a whole lot more had he gone out and kicked a goal that won the world championship for him.
My sentiments, exactly. He's the best penalty kicker on their team because he's got those big feet. He's 6'1". He's a skinny guy with big feet. He can really spin the ball, you know. Mm-hmm. You can put a lot on it when you have a big foot surface to go against the ball.
He did in the one penalty kick.
Yes, talk about skill. He pulled that guy right out of his shoes.
Yeah.
And not only that, but with Zidane in the center at the end of two overtimes and the Italians completely exhausted from playing defense for 115 minutes, there was every chance that that one last bit of pressure on goal would have gotten them a goal. But they weren't going to accomplish it a man down. And they were down as soon as Zidane had his temper tantrum. And he went back home, and the French kind of bucked up, and Chirac said thank you, and they gave him the golden ballon as the player of the tournament. And
yeah, which it looks like they may take back.
Really?
Well,
I hadn't heard that. But I guess if they'd finished this investigation and decide to give him some kind of real citation. Well, he's retiring from international play anyway, so that doesn't matter. But what a way to go out after being the hero of your country. I mean, he's the guy that practically single-handedly won the World Cup in 98.
Well,
and then they beat the Italians in that international championship in 2000.
Can you just imagine, though, somewhere Beckham is in a pub having a pint and going, hey, I'm off the hook.
I'm not Zinedine Zidane. The English have a Frenchman to kick around. Anyway, it was kind of a shocking ending, but my wife works with a bunch of Italians, and we've been to Rome a time or two to go visit. I always rode along with her on the business trips, you know, got a red eye on the local airline so I could go and tour the ruins of classic Rome while she went to business meetings all day. And so I've met these guys and had dinner with them, and she talked to them one morning on the phone after the World Cup, and they were all hoarse.
Oh, God, I don't doubt it.
Hello, Suzanne. It's nice to talk to you.
You would know they were in St. Peter's Square the night before till 3 o'clock
in
the morning.
Actually shocked they were in the office the next day.
It was kind of exciting. I enjoyed the World Cup. We were over in Europe, of course, the last World Cup in 2002. I watched almost every game of it. It was broadcast on BBC and on quite a few local Belgian and French channels, all of which I could get. So I kind of became a closet fan of football, which is now soccer again for me because I've come home and remembered what football actually is.
Well, it's not a bad thing because, you know, at Brewing Frog Manor, we do occasionally, if there's just seemingly nothing else on, which oddly enough, even with a satellite dish, there really isn't a whole lot on. That
57
just,
channels and nothing on.
Yeah, that's it. Pretty wretched. But I'll just flip over to whatever the Spanish stations are, and what do you know? They got Mexican League soccer going on.
That's right. And you don't need a translator.
They're,
especially when they score. Get it, get it. Give him an award for lung capacity.
Somewhere they've got a wing in the broadcast museum for guys like that. It's just like extra lung capacity.
Longest utterance of gola.
Yeah.
Goal. I think they call it the Golden Earplug Award.
Oh, don't be ridiculous.
All right. Like I can do anything about that. Let's go back to a subject we were on last week.
Rewind the tape.
You shall not. Let's go back to a subject we were on last week, and that is the outrageous bias of our media as led by the New York Times and the person of its chief editor, El Jefe, Bill Keller. Robbie is still agog and aghast. You'd think he'd be used to it by
I'm
now.
I'm continuing to be amazed by it. The ignorance and stupidity of members of the media who ought to know better.
I've decided that Bill Keller is like Hitler. That Bill Keller is the world's worst terrorist. This is the things they say about Bush. I've decided it's Bill Keller that way, and here's why. Keller is a victim of Bush derangement syndrome.
BDS.
Everything is all right as long as it helps further the taking down of George Bush. There's no moral rule at work in him that is a higher rule or a higher principle than must take down Bush.
To hang that particular yoke on just Bill Keller alone as if he's hauling the wagon all by himself.
Yeah, but he's the spokesman for them. And the rest of them follow along and publish the same stories and give their little journo salutes.
He's just the guy that's currently in the spotlight. He is the executive editor of The Gray Lady, etc. But it's not like he's got literally thousands of minions at other newspapers around the country are cheering him on through this entire thing.
This is true, but he is
the lightning rod du jour.
And in being the lightning rod and trying to explain the reasonableness of his actions, he's just come off smug and arrogant.
Yes, you have to assume
he's speaking for them.
Well, you can go about this two ways when the light suddenly shines on you. You can scurry away like a cockroach, or you can try and brazen it out. And he's chosen option B. And his actions are irrespective of what he's done. He's just going to brazen it out. And you know why he can get away with it? Who's going to tell you about it? His brother minions in the media.
Isn't that the truth? With a few notable exceptions, and I think they're acting to call them on the carpet in their own quiet way. Fox News, I'm amazed how hard they try to actually be neutral. Which we report, you decide. They claim not to take sides. And you would think with all the thoroughgoing side-taking in the rest of the media that Fox would want to lean the other way just to balance the ship. But really, they don't. They just give you information.
And this is one thing that I find interesting in that, yeah, they are trying to shoot down the middle. And I find it funny that they're characterized and pigeonholed as, oh, they're just right-wing news or faux news or, you know, whatever else, you know, the lefties.
Well, that's because on the far left, they think they're in the middle, and there is nobody to the left of them, but anyone to the right of them is suspect because they're middle. When you're on the left, there's only middle, yourself, and right, as in far-right, maniacal, right-wing neocon.
Yes, really. And so the left sees rule.
Bush lied. People died. No blood for oil. Yeah. Halliburton. Ooga booga booga.
Where do I put my club?
But truly, they think Fox is on the right simply because they think they are in the middle.
Well, one thing I always found interesting is how does the media work in terms of programming? You think, okay, well, over here's the Super Bowl. That's what all the guys are watching. What do we put on? We don't have the Super Bowl. Hey, let's put on, girl programming. They're all wanting to watch something. Counter programming. You know, why did Fox rise so meteorically? Well, because there was a great hunger for news that was not biased.
It's just a repeat in television of the Rush Limbaugh story in radio.
Indeed.
Somebody came on that wasn't to the left, or as they consider themselves, in the middle.
Yeah.
And because they weren't, people flocked to them because finally here's an alternative to the only thing we could find on TV for the last 30 years.
There it is, an alternative.
And even if it's not hardcore right-wing propaganda, and it's not, it seems like that to the media on the left because from where they are, it's such a great distance to come over on the political spectrum to where Fox is.
What surprises me is, with the success of Fox News and the huge viewership numbers that they're raking in every ratings period, why hasn't there been somebody else do this? That passeth all understanding. If it worked once, it'll probably work again.
The business model is still out there begging for someone else to come and compete from that position because there's still room. Come on in. The water's still fine.
Big time.
No one will do it.
Yeah, talk radio is still growing.
Talk radio is still growing. Television is still growing for anyone who chooses to do it, not from the perspective of the left. But the story, as Robbie is saying here, is how many of the big TV programming powerhouse companies, and there are a lot in America and in the world, simply will not take that position, even though it's clearly the lucrative position today.
Yeah, gosh. Who are your news people? Who's dead last in the news rankings right now? CBS?
Yeah, but it's close. They're duking it out for that spot.
Yeah, all of them have an anchor around their necks, and they're going down.
Anchor, but that's a funny name for that person.
Indeed.
Like the millstone, the biblical millstone.
Oh, my gosh. But I find it funny. It's like if you're an executive with this network, and you've got zillions of shareholders who are screaming their lungs out that their share prices are dropping like proverbial millstone in pond, hello, news division, you guys are an anchor. Everybody down there is fired. Clean out your desk. Security will escort you out. Let's hire a slew of new people. I mean, what could it possibly hurt? Like the ratings get any lower?
Well, I don't think there's any better proof of the entrenched leftism of the mainstream media than the fact that even faced with the prospect of failure in their current model and huge profitability and success in the Fox News model, that you just can't get any of them to step forward and get with the program, even though it's there for the taking, because no one will do it on an ideological basis. They can't make themselves step over their ideology and pick up the pile of money that's sitting on the table. Yeah.
But I think that this great hunger is you know, for an alternative, counter-programming, if you will, is the one thing that drives talk radio, that drives the explosive growth of the net, the blogosphere, all these different, you know, opinion methods of instruction that just continue to explode. And it simply baffles the old-time business model, the buggy whip model, if you will, of old journalism, old television, old media.
They're going to have to get used to it. The world changed geopolitically when the Soviet Union failed and the world became fully aware for the first time in the last 15 years of how badly socialism and communism went as a model for the business of a nation, how completely failed they are economically, socially, everything fell apart. The Russians, you know, average age of death for men is down below 60 now, and almost all of them die from alcohol-related symptoms. I mean, it's just a terrible thing. A blight of communism and socialism on people is just now starting to be fully understood after the 15 years since the wall fell. And I think that the political view from the left that drives governments to positions like that is the same view that drives newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, Newsweek, Time Magazine, MSNBC, CBS, NBC, ABC.
The usual
CNN.
Suspects.
Ran out of breath there. That's the same political philosophy that drives those people, and they're wondering why their audiences are going down. I think it's just the same thing. It's just a general worldwide awareness of the relative merits of different worldviews, which were squashed in a very big way in the 70s and the 80s. People didn't understand how badly the Soviets were doing because they kept all their secrets. And now that we know how badly they did and we understand that that worldview is essentially a failure on all levels, that it's getting less and less credence from Americans as a whole in other areas, and the media is a big one.
I find it so interesting. You know, way back, you know, in the day, again, you know, pre-1989, I had quite a bit of business over in Western Europe and would travel there frequently. And on one trip, you know, and you knew what was happening over there. You talked to people and, you know, hey, what's going to happen with this anyway? Because everyone knew that the Soviet Union was just collapsing. Enough cards been pulled from the base that the structure was beginning to collapse.
But they were also worried about what they would do in their death throes, and they were very glad Reagan had our missiles over
exactly.
there.
Exactly, yes. And I remember the protests against those, too. Weren't they misguided? So there we were, and they said, you'd better go to Berlin while it still is, so you can see it as it is now. Because in the future, it's going to be something completely different. And sure enough, there we were. Checkpoint Charlie, the whole...
Well, the Brandenburg Gate used to be the opening of the Black Abyss.
Oh, yeah. What used to be City Hall, which is now filled with the monuments of all the people the East German Border Guard shot while trying to escape tyranny. I still find it amazing that if you go to that place and you look at it and you think, oh, God, I can't believe that could possibly have happened. And yet it did. People lived it. That was their life. I was talking to a young West German girl, Berliner, and she just, I said, what are you going to do with the rest of the wall? This is, I guess, 2 years after it fell. And she says, we're going to leave this one section up just as a monument as to what it was so that people don't forget, because everybody seems to be forgetting about it now. And that really is a danger. You have to remember these things. She says, I wish we could tear it down and forget it ever existed, but it needs to stand there as a lesson.
The Israeli slogan for the last 50 years has been never again, always remember, never forget. And guess what? Now we have world leaders making speeches that the Holocaust didn't happen. I mean, 50 years.
One of whom is doing his darndest to get nuclear weapons.
No sooner do the elders of the generation that knew the horror start to die away than there is a powerful political force trying to change history, trying to alter what happened so that people won't remember. A lot of people know the story of Soviet Union schools where the textbooks got rewritten every few years and photographs got airbrushed and people got rearranged, where The guy standing next to the premier one year, in the next year, that guy's gone, and the guy standing far away from him is now standing next to him. Otherwise, it's the same photograph. They did the same thing with the facts of history. Textbooks got rewritten every few years. The Russians always did the right thing, and America always failed, and nothing bad ever happened under communism. The point being, I think, that under leftist ideologies, control of the minds of young people is mandatory in order for the ideology to catch hold of the next generation. If they have the chance to hear other ideas, if they have the chance to think for themselves, let's face it, socialism, communism are done for. They're done for. And I think this is part of the explanation, although I don't want to state it too strongly because it is a complex mix of factors, but it's part of the explanation as to why the NEA, under the control of the left, is held onto with such an iron grip. Why the curriculum in our schools seems so wacky and pointless and unhelpful and contrary to the values that we have, and yet every year it gets worse than the year before.
I don't even know what they're teaching in school, to be very honest. I'm not a school-age kid anymore. I haven't been for a long time. Don't really know any kids that are in school. Hey, little Johnny.
Okay, see you next week. Same X time, same X channel. No, X-Man.